But anyhow, I am grateful to be here. I'm grateful to be an alcoholic. You know, of all the things I'll say from this podium, probably the most important thing that I'll say is that my name's Jay and I'm an alcoholic. Because I know who I am and I know what I am today. And I didn't know either of them or like any of that when I got here. I was just an average guy when I got here. You know, I said, I'm glad to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I truly am. I think it's the greatest gift ever given to me. We'll go into that a little bit. And I guess I'm grateful to be an alcoholic. And to tell you something about that, I was sitting in a meeting sober a month or two, and I heard a guy say, I'm grateful to be an alcoholic. I said, somebody ought to slap that sumbitch. I was 30 and a half years old. How could you be grateful to be an alcoholic? And I thought, look at what he's, you know, I mean, he's old. He was 50-some years old. He should be grateful he's still alive, for God's sakes. But I thought about that, and, you know, as time went on, and I finally got into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was sober about 2.5 years, and I was in a meeting, and I heard a comment I made. And I said my name, and I said, and I'm grateful to be an alcoholic. And I truly was. Because had I not been an alcoholic, I would never have found this way of life. Now, when I got here, I didn't know what an alcoholic was. I could identify an alcoholic. All I had to do was look around, and I could spot them. You know, if I saw someone like Kent, and it was so good to see Kent this morning, but if I saw someone like Kent, I knew he was an alcoholic, you know. I mean, there was that thing you could just spot about him. You know, you could see, just picture him foraging around in a garbage can in a trench coat, you know, looking into his eyes, there's nobody home, nobody going to live there anymore. That's probably an alcoholic. But I did not picture myself as that. You know, I was a 30-and-a-half-year-old guy. I'd been thrown out of the Merchant Marine, blackballed out of the Merchant Marine. And for those that aren't familiar here in Mississippi what the Merchant Marine is, getting blackballed or thrown out of the Merchant Marine is very similar to getting blackballed out of prison. You've got, I need to say no more to qualify for my being here. It's hard to get thrown out, but I did. I was unemployable. My marriage was in terrible shape. Everything was a zoo. But I didn't think I was an alcoholic. What I thought was I might have a problem drinking. You know, I thought I might have a problem drinking, but an alcoholic, I didn't think I was an alcoholic. I thought I was just a normal guy doing normal things. Normal things. When I was a little kid, as far back as I can remember, I was a liar. Now, nobody taught me how to lie. There wasn't no books on it. I couldn't read back then anyhow. But it came natural, sort of like a gift from God. By lying, I could make myself into whatever you wanted me to be. If you wanted me to be intelligent, I'd tell you how smart I was. You wanted me to be a criminal. Whatever I told you, whatever you wanted, I could tell you, and I'd believe it. And the difference between the lies that I told and the lies that I heard is that I could spot the lies that people told me. And many times they didn't spot the lies that I told them. And if they did spot them, I'd confront them. And I'd fight. Now, I didn't win, but I'd fight. Always had been a fighter, never had been a winner. In fact, I got more assaulting and officer tickets in my life than most men have hair on their head. And never once did I find any bruises on my knuckles. All I found was my face busted up, so I must have hit him with my face, you know. But I got the ticket and they got the pleasure. But anyhow. So if you didn't believe my lies, I got mad about it. And I was a thief as far back as I can remember. Now, being a liar didn't make me an alcoholic. It just made me a liar. Now, I hear some people say, well, that's the trait of an alcoholism. Hell, that's the trait of a liar. Unfortunately, lying comes along with alcoholism for most of us. But it doesn't make us an alcoholic. And I was a thief as far back as I can remember. I didn't picture myself as a thief. I thought I was a short, fat Robin Hood. I may take something from Angela. I'd get turn around and give it to Brandon. I wouldn't think about maybe she'd worked hard to earn the money to pay for whatever it was that I stole from her. But I'd think to myself, if I give it to him, he'd say I was a nice guy and want me to hang around. Now, if I was talking to one of them counselors or therapists or something, they'd tell me I was trying to buy someone's attention or buy their affection. And I guess that I was, but I didn't know that I was. And that didn't make me an alcoholic. I hear these words, people please, and all that. I don't know what all that crap means. I just did what I did. Nobody taught me it. But I think it's a part of alcoholism. But what it really was then is it made me a thief. So there I was, a liar and a thief, and I was full of anger. I didn't know I was angry. I just thought I was normal. I didn't know I was angry until I was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous for a while. And I was a mad guy first year and a half I was here. You know, and what I'm going to try and do today, it says in the big book we share what we were like, what happened, and what I am like today. And I'm going to try and do that. And I'm going to try not to go through the steps the way I've done many times in my talk, but more tell you more about what I was like, what happened to me, and what I'm like today. I say that for a real good reason. In Alcoholics Anonymous, I identified. I have never been able to listen to an intellectual lecture on alcoholism. I don't give a shit who made it. If you want to talk, pardon my language, if you want to talk about the metabolism of alcoholism, go to the Yale University or something. But I want to hear about how you drank and what happened when you drank and how you thought when you drank, because I don't ever want to forget how I thought when I drank, how I felt when I drank, and why I had to pick up that next drink, why I believed that lie. I was so proficient at lying that I could believe that lie, the lie that this time I could pick up a drink and it'd be different. This time I'd pick up a drink and I wouldn't go there, I wouldn't hurt them, or I wouldn't do that. And I tell myself that lie and I believe that lie. Bill talks about it. He talks about the mind of the alcoholic. Obsession of the mind, the doctor called it. Bill talks about the mind. We have a strange mind. We believe stuff that isn't so. I've got no proof that alcohol ever worked for me, really worked. But I had the feeling that it worked. And there's a big difference between feeling that it worked and knowing that it worked. Feeling that it worked just meant that I felt better for a brief period of time. And then I'd come to, wake up, or get my head back, and I'd be full of a thing called shame, guilt, and remorse. Those are great gifts given to an alcoholic. Guilt especially. I love guilt. You know, I'm guilt. I think that Hallmark needs to put out a card. Guilt, the gift that keeps on giving. It just fits. You know, but that guilt is the thing that drove me here. It wasn't the hangovers. It was the guilt, the remorse, and the shame. But I had this stuff going on. I had guilt and remorse going on, but not a lot of shame, long before I took a drink. So there I am, a liar and a thief and full of anger, and I went off to the first grade with that stuff inside of me. My first school was a Catholic school. I was born in the Midwest, a suburb of Cleveland, Ohio. And if you were Catholic, you went to a Catholic school if your family could afford it. And they sent me to a Catholic school, and I had my first experience with S&M, with Sister Lucy. Sister Lucy was a first grade teacher. You got to picture how they dressed back then. I'm almost 70 years old. I'm 69. But back then, 60 years ago or 60-some years ago, nuns dressed like nuns. They wore these black habits or gowns. They went from their head down to their toes. They had boots with high heels on them. And they had leather and chains hanging down their side. And they'd make noises when they walked. And she just scared the hell out of me. Halfway through the first grade, they called my parents in, had a parent-teacher conference, told my parents that it appeared as though I was a gifted child and I could go far, that I had a good intellect. As soon as I heard that conversation, because I was standing outside eavesdropping, well, it was important, I wanted to know what was being said. When I heard how smart I was, my ability to learn stopped. So my education effectively came to a halt, and I began getting into trouble. By the second grade, I'm put in front of the class as a class clown. Now I was starting to get labels on me. By the third grade, things were so bad at home. You know, I was raised in an upper middle class home. My dad was a news commentator at a coast to coast radio show. He was a big shot. He had his picture on billboards and on buses, and not on milk cartons, but buses. And he was a big shot and knew a lot of famous people, and he made good money. My daddy was also an alcoholic. So he was a little better at spending money than he was earning money, so I didn't get none of the money. But I never felt that my dad loved me. He was never my daddy. He was always my dad. My mother, I didn't think, liked me. I had three sisters. I had one sister that was a year older, one that was a year younger, and one that was five years younger, my baby sister. I was later to have a kid brother 18 years younger than I. And I saw my siblings given physical and emotional love and attention. I saw them given material things, and I'm sure that because of what they were given, I was given the very same things and the same emotional love. But there was something inside of me that kept me from ever feeling it or kept me from ever remembering it. And I think that's a part of alcoholism. But it didn't make me an alcoholic. It just made me more confused and mad and upset. there I was in school, had all that anger and stuff going on inside of me, and I began running away. I always thought if I ran somewhere else and found something else, it'd be better. It was always going to be better over there. So I'd run, they'd catch me and bring me back, and I was stealing and lying and running, and they started locking me up. They put me in front of a juvenile referee when I was 8 or 9 years old. And they sent me off to an orphanage. And that didn't make no sense to me. I wasn't an orphan. There wasn't no orphans in there. They were just guys like me. They labeled me incorrigible. Now, being uneducated and not having a very good vocabulary, my words were limited to very small syllable words, usually had terrible meanings, but I had to look up that word one time, see what it meant. It was just a four-syllable word meant punk. I was just a 8 or 9 year old punk. They sent off this other place with other incorrigibles, other punks. I thought they were punishing me. They weren't punishing me. They were trying to rehabilitate me. They wanted me to be able to fit into society. But I didn't see it that way. I thought they were doing it to me, not for me. And because I thought they were doing it to me, I wanted to get back at them for it. And I was to stay there a while and then got out of there, supposedly rehabilitated, kept lying, stealing, and running, and got locked up again. And to make a long story very short, I was to stay locked up off and on from then on until I was about 17 years old. Every time I got back out on the streets, I'd do the same behavior and go back to the same places. Now, mind you, starting at 8 or 9, I wasn't drinking. I was just being a punk. At 13, a miracle came into my life. I decided to take a drink. Don't ask me why, because I don't know why. I'm sure I'd ingested the beverage alcohol many, many times prior to age 13 because of the environment that I grew up in. My daddy drank all the time. Before he'd go to work in the morning, at 4:30 in the morning, he'd have a big glass of vodka with him. When he came home at night, he had a glass of vodka in his hand. He'd drink until he took a nap and passed out or whatever. Come down, eat dinner, and he'd be drinking again. Mom would have 2 drinks every night just to relax. And they drank all the time. I never saw him slur his words or fall down. So yeah, I never associated any of that. He just drank. And the family had get-togethers 3 or 4 times a year with all the in-laws and all the others come over, and they'd have kegs of wine and cases of beer and cases of liquor, and they'd all drink. And once in a while, somebody'd get drunk and start a fight, but mostly they just drank. And whenever they drank, they gave us kids some of what the grown-ups had. We'd get a little wine or a little mixed drink or a little beer. It did nothing to me or for me. So I guess you could say that was my social drinking. Because I just drank it. I'd just have a little bit and go on about my business. Did nothing to me or for me. But at 13, I decided to drink. I knew I wasn't old enough to drink. Hell, I didn't even look 13, and you had to be 21 in Ohio to drink. So I stole an eyebrow pencil from my mother's purse, and I dotted on a 5 o'clock shadow. Now, I have no idea what it looked like, but I'd pay a lot of money for a picture of it. I'm real glad it didn't rain. What I looked like was a 13-year-old punk with a lot of blackheads, I'm sure. But I stole some money from her purse, too, and we headed down to the lower end of 25th Street. That's a skid row in Cleveland, and every city, every town's got a skid row. And we headed down to the lower end of 25th Street. We went out in and out of enough gin mills where they finally gave us what we wanted. We got 2 bottles of mixed screwdrivers and 2 bottles of Thunderbird wine. I can only imagine why we ordered the screwdrivers. It implied something sexual. I didn't know what it implied, but it sounded good. The Thunderbird, I can tell you why we ordered it. There was a billboard darn near as big as that whole wall over by James. And it had a bottle on that billboard, and it showed this bird just soaring free. It just was beautiful, beautiful billboard. I closed my eyes, I could just see it. And it was what I'd learned about it. What's the word? Thunderbird! I mean, it promised something was going to happen, I'll tell you that. If you think I'm kidding, you go home and try and do with that with Mad Dog or Ripple or... It just don't get it. But anyhow, we got that hooch and went out of that bar and went behind some bushes and we started to drink. Don't know what one we started with, don't know what it tasted like. But I can tell you what happened shortly after we started to drink, whichever one we started to drink. For the very first time in my life, everything came together. And I had a feeling come over me that had to be the most fantastic feeling a guy like me could ever feel. Because I was going to seek to recapture that feeling at every opportunity for the next 17 and a half years. I was okay and everything was going to be all right. Unfortunately, that drink set in play the thing that we call alcoholism. Because what I had to do was take another drink and another. And I came to the next morning, or woke up the next morning, back at my parents' home, laying in a mess, and it was mine. I had a new fear about me. Didn't know what it was. I was just afraid. And I didn't remember what happened the night before after I started to drink. Now, if one of you would have told me, Jay, you had a blackout, I'd have said, you're crazy. I didn't have a blackout. I just don't remember. I didn't know that those were synonyms. They meant the same thing. You know, I've later found out there's a lot of people that are as seriously alcoholic as I am who have never had a blackout. So you do not have to have a blackout to become an alcoholic. But on the other side of that coin, I have yet to meet an individual who has had a blackout related to drinking that was not an alcoholic. So I had this symptom of alcoholism. Hell, I was 13 years old, for God's sakes. If one of you would have told me that I was an alcoholic, I'd have said you were crazy. How can I be an alcoholic? I haven't even had a zit yet. I was to get locked up shortly after that and was sent away on an indefinite sentence. And I didn't drink for the next few years, and then I ran away from there, and I went down on a skid row, and I got a wino on a skid row to sign me into the service under the pretenses that he was my father. He wasn't. He was just a guy. And he signed me into the service, and I went away to Great Lakes Naval Training Center for an eight-week boot camp. And I wrote my parents a letter, and I told them where I was, that I left that reformatory, and I was in a boot camp, and I was going to be in the service. I was going to make them proud of me. I was to find out later that my parents, the very first thing that happened when I got away from that reformatory, the law went to their house to get me. They were looking for me because I was an escaped criminal. My parents got some money, and they'd fallen on hard times, but they got some money, and they got a lawyer to petition the juvenile courts to allow me to stay in the service. Back in the early 60s, they could do that, and the courts allowed me to stay in the service because they were going to have to turn me loose at 18 anyhow. So they thought if I stayed in the service 3-4 years that I could become a productive human being, and that semi-controlled environment would help structure me. My career in the service don't take long to talk about. Just shortly after, 6 months after I went in, I woke up one morning in a place, a room maybe a third this size. It had big windows in it with big thick screens on the inside of it. The last thing I'd remembered, I'd been on an aircraft carrier, the USS Antietam, down out of Pensacola, Florida, and we'd been out on a training exercise, come in, and I'd gone ashore to get a drink, and I woke up the next morning in this room. And what it was the nut ward of the Naval Hospital in Pensacola, Florida. It seems like I'd gone back to the ship, and I didn't have any clothes on, and I was all beat up, and I was drunk and blacked out. And they called me before board officers, and they gave me a paper, and they said if I signed it, that they'd give me an honorable discharge. If I didn't sign it, they were going to court-martial me and throw me out with a dishonorable discharge. That's an easy choice for a guy like me. I signed the paper. They said I forfeited all rights and benefits. That's all right. They didn't have nothing I wanted. And it was a guarantee I'd never attempt to reenlist in any of the armed forces as long as I lived. That was fine with me. That's been a long time ago. I ain't been back. Don't plan on going back. I kept that promise, I'll tell you that. But they gave me what money I had coming, and I was thrown out of the Navy. Had that honorable discharge, and I headed from Florida back up to Ohio. It was time for me to see my parents. I had not seen them in a while, and they needed to see their son, who was going to make them proud. And I got a car on the way back up there. Now, I didn't get any insurance, and I didn't get registration, and I got a license. I did get a license since I got into Ohio. Never had driven before, and I headed up there, and I began to celebrate my 18th birthday. And I woke up the next morning like I woke up the last time I drank. Because, see, something went on inside my head. I felt so bad and felt so wrong about how things were going. You know, if they'd just give me a break, if they'd give me a chance, if they'd let me try it my way and not get in my business, I'd be all right. But they were always messing with me, and I took that drink, and it kept getting worse. When I got that car, I was driving up there, I decided to have a drink to celebrate my birthday. And when I believe that thing going on in my head, and I took that drink, and I set in play that allergy that only people like you and I have. If you're not an alcoholic, you can't make yourself an alcoholic just by getting drunk. People get drunk. Anyone that drinks liquor will get drunk. My wife will take a drink. She'll get drunk eventually. But unless it sets in play that allergy of the body, the doctor talks about it. He calls it a phenomenon. I didn't know what a phenomenon was. You know what I mean? I told you I had a limited vocabulary. I looked it up. It comes from a Greek word that meant I don't know. So I had I don't know about what I don't know. I know it sounds strange, but that's what it is. So I had this I don't know about what I don't know going on. It made me take another drink. this phenomena, this allergy, an allergy that only people like you and I have. And I took that drink and took another drink and another drink, and I woke up in that jail that next morning, all beat up again. And a cop came there, and he had a handful of tickets, started with drunk driving, resisting arrest, assaulting an officer, leaving the scene of an accident. There was about eight of them there. And he gave them all to me, and he let me out on my own recognizance. Not because I appeared to be a good citizen, but because my mother was clerk of courts of that small town. I got out of that jail, and I felt bad, and I needed a drink, and I didn't have no money, and I really needed a drink bad. And somehow my money all got gone the night before. And I walked over to my mother's house, and I went in, and I remember going in, and she was in the living room with my sister. It was my sister that was a year younger. She had just joined the Ursuline Convent. She was a novitiate, and she'd gone to my mother's house that day because my mother was upset. And I walked in, and my mother was crying. And my mother was crying. I looked at her, and I couldn't figure out. I said, what's wrong? And I'm thinking to myself, why is she crying? I'm the one that should be crying. I smell. I need a drink. I'm sick. I'm ashamed. I feel full of guilt. Why is she crying? And she looked up at me and talked to me. She said, no, your dad's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had known it. They had told me that when they'd seen me in boot camp. My dad got sober in a place called Rosary Hall. That's in Cleveland, Ohio. Sister Ignatia ran it when he was there. And he'd gone in there for 5 days in detox, and they kept him in straps in a hallway because he was in convulsions. And they thought he'd die. And after 5 days, his sponsor took him from there. They only kept him 5 days. And Sister Ignatia gave him this little Sacred Heart thing that she gave all them guys when they left. And she said to him, Jim, she said, if you go with your sponsor to Alcoholics Anonymous and do what those men and women tell you to do, you'll never have to come off another drunk. And my daddy went with his sponsor to Alcoholics Anonymous, and he never drank from that day through the day of his death, March 25th, 1981. He listened to you and did what you told him to do. But anyhow, she's telling me that he's not drinking and he's going to Alcoholics Anonymous. She said, and God has blessed us. And I'm wondering, what's this? God's blessed you. She said, now, you got to remember, my dad was 51, my mom was 49. She said, since your dad's been sober, she said, I'm pregnant. And I'm praying that this child inside of me will be born dead rather than be born of a child like you. And I thought to myself, you bitch. You know, when I would hear myself say over the years since that had happened, I'm only hurting myself, I'm not hurting anyone but me. Through the benefit of an inventory and looking back through my life, I see how much I've damaged anyone and everyone that came in contact with me. Things I stole from them were far more important than material things. The love, the emotion that I robbed from them. But I didn't think that then. When she told me that, I told you what I thought of her. And I said, how soon can I get away from them? And I got away from them and I left. They told me I was a lousy sailor, so I did what many of you might have done. I joined the Merchant Marine. I became a professional seaman. Now that ain't in the service. That's different. You're a civilian. And I went away on my first ship, and we went to a country called Japan. And I went ashore. I hadn't had a drink in a few months. Went ashore, went into a bar, and I remember the captain came and got me out of a Japanese jail 3 days later. Brought me back to the ship and put me in a logbook. That is not a position of honor, by the way. That means you're fired. And I was scared. You know, I was a little young kid and just 18 years old and scared to death, and I had all these professional seamen around me. They were all old, most of them drunks. And the captain told me I was fired. These guys told me don't worry about it. So we all get fired or quit. We got over 300 ships under union agreement. Each ship is a separate entity. And according to the union contract, if you get fired off one ship, they can't refuse you employment on another ship. Each voyage is from 3 months to 1 year long. I'd done the math. 300 times the median length of voyage of 6 months, I'd be older than Methuselah before I run out of ships. So I had a career. Wasn't afraid of that no more. We came back to San Pedro. They paid me off in $100 bills because that's how they paid you. Then you didn't get a check or no wire transfer. They just give you the cash. And they don't give you no money on a ship. You get 10% of your pay on a ship and all of the rest of it when you get off. Unless you got a family and then you send an allotment home. They still give you a big pile of money when you get off, whatever you've earned. You didn't make a lot an hour, but you worked a lot of hours and you got that money. And I got off that ship with that handful of money and I went into some bars, bought me some nice clothes and went into some bars. Felt superior to the people with whom I was around, and I drank. And when I ran out of money, I went back on another ship. And if I ran out of money and couldn't get a ship, I took jobs. I worked for all kinds of places. One time I built pools for Anthony Pools, who was a helper there. Another time I was driving an ambulance in West Palm Beach, Florida, on a crash rescue squad, saving lives, and got arrested for drunk driving and hit skip. I'm trying to help people, and I'm getting in trouble. You know what I mean? It wasn't fair. It was just bad situations and circumstances. My driving career, by the way, was about as good as my naval career. I got my license on my 18th birthday. They took it away from me that night, and I never got a legal license back again until I was sober 3.5 years. Please don't misunderstand me. As you can tell by the ambulance driving, I didn't quit driving. I just quit having legal licenses. I've had a Mississippi license, Arkansas license, Washington, you name a state, I had a license there. They didn't have computers back then, so you just got them. And drunk driving tickets wasn't no more than a nuisance. You just got one, ignore it, go on, pay the bail. So I kept going, and things kept getting worse, and I wanted them to get better. And I said, well, maybe if I go up the ladder in a merchant marine, things get better. So I began going up the ladder. I began being endorsed for refrigeration engineering, for just different stuff, hydraulics, and just different stuff. And as I went up, things kept getting worse. And I said, I know what it is. If I become an officer in a merchant marine, everyone knows that officers are gentlemen. I'll become an officer in a merchant marine, and I'll be an officer and a gentleman. So I studied hard. I had the ability to retain knowledge. And I had, at that time of my drinking, the ability to at times go without a drink for periods of time. And that, what I thought was an ability, and I use that word very questionably, created in me a delusion that there wasn't a problem because I wasn't a daily drinker. So I'd go a week, a month, or 2 months at a time without taking a drink. And then something would go off inside my head. That thing we call the obsession of the mind or the mind of the alcoholic, that strange insanity that precedes the first drink. Something would click in there and it'd say, you know, if you just take one drink, you'll feel better. If you take one drink, some of that anxiety will go away. Some of that fear will go away. You'll feel a little more relaxed. You'll be able to do a better job. And I'd listen to that a lot long enough, and I'd forget all about that. I just got out of jail or just got fired or whatever happened just before. And I'd listen to that voice, and I'd take that drink, and off I'd go. And then I'd wake up, come to, or just have my eyes open for a minute, and I'd have that guilt riding over me and that shame and that remorse. If I just think about today, I remember. That's why I listen to drunk logs. I don't want to forget those feelings that came over me. Those feelings that I wanted to go away and I couldn't get them to go away. And the only way I could get them to go away is by taking that thing that would relieve them, another drink of alcohol. Not knowing that that drink would set in play that terrible allergy that would command me to take another drink and another drink and another drink until I woke up with still more guilt, anxiety, and remorse and shame. But anyhow, things got worse. I got that license in the merchant marine and things did get worse. One time, I haven't told this story in many, many years. One time we were over in a country called Ceylon. I was later to have a business, a smuggling business over there. But we were over in a country called Ceylon, and I went ashore to buy some souvenirs or something, and mainly to get drunk. And they were trying to bring me back to the ship, and I wanted to stay ashore because the party wasn't over for me. And these guys were carrying me back to the ship, and I didn't know what happened, but I woke up the next morning in a room on the ship. They called it a hospital. It was just an empty room. They had me chained to a bed. And the cap put me in a logbook and fired me, of course, and it didn't mean anything. Whenever you get fired on a ship in a foreign country, you don't have to worry. You ain't going to walk home. I mean, you know, you get fined a day's pay and you just go on about your business. You know, you're fired when you get back. Who cares? You quit anyhow. But I come to that next morning, I was feeling sick, shamed, and guilty, and about a year and a half later than that, I got subpoenaed into court. It seems like one of them guys who was carrying me back to the ship, they had me in this little boat with a motor on it, and some Indian guy riding a boat back there, he made the mistake of sitting on my face trying to get me to quit trying to jump out the boat to swim back ashore. I can't swim. And it seems like I bit him rather severely, and he was suing the company for damages to his ass. But if I didn't see it in written testimony, I wouldn't believe it. But they had pictures and everything. It was just, so I was an officer and a gentleman in a merchant marine. I mean, I just give you a picture of who's standing before you. You get a little better view there. But, and things kept getting worse. And then I thought to myself, I said, you know, I made a study. I ain't a dumb guy. I made a study. Most of the guys who were having trouble were guys like me. Guys that didn't have a lot of responsibility. They just had money to spend. And I spent everything plus what I, you know, anything I got I spent, and plus I go in debt. So the only way that I could correct some of this is get some responsibility. So I said, well, I'll get married. If I got married and had a couple kids and a house and a fence and all that stuff, I'd be all right. So I was sitting in a bar one day shopping for a wife, and she walked in. Well, by then, all I did was drink and go to sea. But she walked in and sat down next to me. She's a little bitty redhead. James knew her. It might be a couple others in here. And her name was Vaughn. She sat down next to me. She was a little bitty girl, like 4'10" tall, had red hair, and she was mad. She had the worst look of anger on her face you ever seen in your life. I'd never seen her before. I knew she wasn't mad at me. I felt superior to her because I was bigger than her. I wasn't as mad as her, so I felt superior. But anyway, I hauled out all that money I had in my pocket from getting off that ship and sort of smeared them $100 bills out there, and her eyes looked down, and I started lying, and she started listening. I found out what had happened. She had the choke marks on her neck and the black eye and a fat lip because her husband had just beaten her very badly, and he had left her, deserted her. She had a baby that was just a few months old and another child that was 4 years old. And she'd been married to that man for almost 5 years, and he'd beaten her on a regular basis. And she hated men, and she hated anything to do with alcohol. And this guy wasn't an alcoholic, he was just a wife-beaten drunk. She didn't want nothing to do with alcohol or men. Now, that's a challenge. I began to court her. After a lengthy courtship, I proposed to her. If she were alive and able to talk to you right now, she'd tell you it was 10 minutes. I personally think it was 20 minutes. I mean, well, ask yourself, don't us alcoholics take a long time with important decisions? And 20 minutes sounds like a lot more reasonable. But make a long story short, that was in 1963, I believe, or 65, I can't remember the exact year. But her divorce became final on October 14th of the next year, and we got married on October 15th. And we got married at the Candlelight Flower Shop in West Palm Beach, Florida, on Congress Avenue. I remember buying the rings at the farmer's market across the street. I remember thinking about this marriage. Now, you got to think back 50 years ago, or near 50 years ago, I didn't know nothing about divorces. There was no divorce in my family. No cousins, no nobody. Everybody just got married and stayed married. I didn't know people that got divorced. You just stayed married. So I figured you get married, you stay married. I didn't think about the responsibility of children coming into their marriage and the dynamics and all that. There was none of that going on. I was just going to marry her. I remember that little boy, Ricky, holding on to my pant leg, looking up at me, crying, saying, "Please be my daddy." And as he said that, I knew what he was saying because I'd grown up without a daddy. I'd had a dad, but I hadn't had a daddy. And I swore I was going to be his daddy. I remember that little girl, Kim. Now, Kim's a year old, and I'm holding her in my arms, a little over a year, I'm holding her in my arms. And even though I hadn't conceived either of those children, I was going to be their daddy. And I could picture life with them and what I'd do for them and with them, how I'd protect them and care for them. I remember as I took those vows with my wife, Vaughn, I thought about those vows, and I was going to give her security, and I was going to give her peace of mind, and I was going to be faithful to her. I was going to give her happiness. And I meant it with every bit of sincerity I had in my being. And had one of you told me that alcoholism would keep me from it, I said, "You're crazy." I thought my wanting to do it, my willing to do it, my willpower would allow me to do it. And I failed so miserably. We left that wedding, went over to her aunt's house where I had a little reception. They gave us those stuff they give you, hot plates and stuff that you either keep or re-gift later. But we had all that stuff. And as I was at that way at that reception, I got mad because they gave me a glass of punch. I don't like punch. The only way I'll drink punch is if it's full of vodka or gin. Now, prior to marrying Vaughn, I'd been a professional wedding goer. You all seen that movie, Wedding Crashers? I'd perfected that stuff long before that movie come out. I was not going there looking for women. I went there when I was broke. I was looking for drinks. If you put on a nice suit and didn't puke on no one or throw a punch, it had to be a bigger city. I don't know if you get away with it in Columbus, but you can get away with it like in Birmingham or Cleveland or Chicago, Los Angeles. Go to a Polish or Italian wedding. All you got to do is say, "I'm with them," and point at somebody, and, you know, you're fine. But first time you puke or throw a punch, you're out of there. So, you know, be careful. But so I'd been to a lot of weddings, and I knew how to celebrate at a wedding. Now I'm at my wedding, and there's no one to celebrate with because she won't drink. So I grabbed her, and we left, and we stopped at a liquor store, and I bought a bottle. We were going down from West Palm down to Miami for a two-day honeymoon, and I bought a big jug, and And I started to drink, and she wouldn't have none. I picked a guy up on the side of the road to help me celebrate. He was just a bum. And we passed the bottle back and forth across my new wife. And I woke up the next morning the same way I woke up the last time I took a drink. I woke up in that mess, and it was mine. I woke up with that fear about me. I was just eating up with it. Had that guilt and remorse and shame. And I couldn't remember what I'd done the night before after I started to drink. And I remember looking over at her and saying, "What's wrong?" And she told me. She said, "I've lived this way before, and I will not live this way again." And I took a vow, the most solemn vow I've ever taken. I swore to her that if she'd give me one more chance, I would never behave that way again. I begged her for that chance, and she gave it to me. And I was to break that vow over and over and over again for the next 10 years. And things kept getting worse. And I didn't want them to get worse. I wanted them to get better because the way my mind had worked, if I do this, this will happen. If I do that, that'll happen. But I couldn't do this because what I do is the other part of my mind to say, if you take a drink, you'll feel better. I can only guess how that marriage stayed together. I'd write her letters. I went back on ships. I stayed on ships. I'd be gone 6 months. One time I was gone 13 or 14 months. Not back home, not in the States. I'd send her money every month or they'd send the allotment home. I'd get off the ship, come with that pile of money in my pocket. She'd meet the plane wherever it flew into. She'd have them kids with her, the two older ones and then the one that was born to us in 1968, little Jay. And she'd meet the ship, and when I'd see her, she'd have that big smile on her face. Her husband was home. And she'd be glad to see me, and everything was fine until I got close enough that she could smell me, and I'd be drunk. And the glow would go out of her face like you threw ice water on her. We'd go to the house, and I'd be drinking, and it'd get worse. And we couldn't get no worse, I'd ship out again, and I'd write her those letters again and tell her I was sorry and tell her things had changed and I'd do something different this time. And she'd get enough of them and believe it, and I'd come home and it'd start again. Because something would go off inside my mind, somewhere between the letter and when I started back to the, you know, wherever I was. If I just took a drink, I'd feel better. I want to be happy and cheerful when I get there. I don't want to be angry, mad, and resentful. Just take one drink. And I swear I'm just going to have one or two. From just take one, it was to one or two. But as soon as I ingested the beverage alcohol, there was no control over how much I was going to drink. Because I had that thing that you told me later I had called alcoholism. That obsession of the mind coupled with the spirit, with the physical allergy. And things kept getting worse. In 1973, I was blackballed out of the Merchant Marine for chronic alcoholism. They took away my Seaman's papers, my license. I already didn't have a driver's license. I was losing everything. My marriage was in such bad shape, I was the most active member of Sex Without Partners in South Florida. That particular self-help group might not have got here yet. Oh, well, I see there are a few members. But anyhow, I found myself on March the 7th of 1974 knocking on a man's back door 1,200 miles away from where we lived. And when he answered the door, the first words out of my mouth were, "I think I have a problem drinking." And I remember that man chuckled. Didn't laugh, he just sort of chuckled and said, "Come on in, son." And he took me back to his study, set me down on a couch, and he reached into his desk, and I don't have one up here, but he reached in and gave me a copy of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he had me open it up. It was a second edition, and I opened it up, and on a flyleaf, there were some words written in ink. It just said, "If you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, God will help." And it was signed, "Love, Dad." And my dad had bought that book for me at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous a number of years before. Because he came to you people and he'd tell you about his son. And he'd tell you that he loved his son, but his son was killing himself. He was drinking himself to death. He was destroying his career, destroying his family, destroying his life. And you did not tell him to intervene or interfere. What you told him was, "Leave him alone. Don't say anything. You can give his wife some pamphlets, let her put them around the house. If he reads them, fine. If he don't read them, fine. But what you need to do is keep your mouth shut and be an example." And I'm so glad he listened to you. I'm so glad there wasn't no well-meaning interventionist out there to try and interfere. Because they said that would have killed me, and it well might have. Because he said nothing. All he was an example of what happens when you don't drink. He went back to work. He went to work with a different company, doing different thing that he had done before, and was making good money and becoming fairly successful again. The family was doing well. Their house, everything was fine. And he wasn't drinking. That's all I knew about him, is that he wasn't drinking. I knew nothing, really, what AA was. I just knew he wasn't drinking. And that's why I'd gone to him. He was an example of drinking and not drinking. And then he said to me, he said, come with me, son. We'll go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, no, I won't go. I'm drunk. He said, that's all right. I'll take anyone to their first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous drunk. He said, not drinking isn't a requirement, just a desire to stop. But I wouldn't go. And he wrote numbers down on a piece of paper, three phone numbers. He said, put them in your billfold. He said, and tomorrow morning, he said, when you wake up, if you wake up, because you might die, but if you wake up, call one of these numbers before you take a drink, and then meet me at 7 tomorrow, and we'll go to a meeting. And I put those numbers in my billfold, and I went out that night, and I drank. Because that's all I did by then. The last 2 years of my drinking were just that. I was either lying drunk, getting off a drunk, and getting ready to get on another drunk. It's all a gray fog. I just don't remember much of it at all. Some of what I told you about the last 2 years was only because I had my wife joined Al-Anon, and she got that instant recall shit that they get. And oh, well, by the way, I don't mean to offend any Al-Anons, but I do want to thank you for that one slogan you gave us, think, think, think. That did not come from a drunk, I'll tell you that. My sponsor to that was, whoops, there go two of them. I didn't mean to upset you. I think they also gave us that, what you hear here, let it stay here. Then why the hell did I come here? But anyhow, my dad said, I'll take anyone to their first meeting, but I wouldn't go. And I went out that night, and next morning I came to, or I woke up, or came out of that blackout. And there was a drink next to me, because there was always a drink next to me. And I physically needed that drink, and I mentally needed that. I needed that drink in every way you could need it. But there was something different. As badly as I wanted and needed that drink, I didn't want to drink just a little bit more. Again, referring to the slogans we see in our meetings, there's one that has real importance to me, and that's the one that says, but for the grace of God. Grace, I found, comes from a Latin word that means gift. And what grace is God's merciful gift, which manifested itself to me that morning as a desire not to drink that was stronger than that overwhelming or almost overwhelming desire to drink. But that gift was given to me as it was given to each of you with the same responsibility, that I do everything I can to keep it or I'd lose it. And if I lose it, there's no guarantee I'd ever get it back again. And that morning I couldn't do much. I just didn't drink. And I wanted to drink. And she took me to a hospital. As soon as we got clothes on, we went to a hospital. And they gave me a shot. And it wasn't the drugs they give today. It was vitamin B12. As I remember, the needle was about that long and it was square. There's a place on your left cheek where they know where to hit it. They said it helped my nerves. I don't know if it did or not. I never forgot the needle, though. But I was to get those shots every day for 2 weeks. It was vitamin B12. And then they told her, give me honey and orange juice. She and I did not have a very good relationship, as I told you. She got Cairo syrup and orange juice. Early March in Cleveland is very cold. It's snowy. It's cold. It's miserable. When you mix Cairo syrup and orange juice, it's like chunks of frozen road tar and orange juice. It'll cut your throat going down, I'll tell you that. And every time I'd open my mouth, she's pouring that stuff in me. And they said it would do the same thing that alcohol did, that it had the sugars in it that alcohol had, and were helping him withdraw from alcohol. They did not tell her to take me to a hospital or to get me admitted anywhere. They said he's going to shake, he's going to have visions, he's going to hear things, but unless he goes into convulsions, let him be sick. If he goes into convulsions, get him to a hospital. If he doesn't, don't. He'll remember being sick. He won't remember being fogged up with medicines. I'm glad that he listened to them old-timers, that she listened to them. I met my dad that night. We went to a meeting much like this, with people much like you. We walked in the door of that meeting, and there was a guy standing there at the door. He was smoking a cigarette, even though then all meetings were smoking. And back then, every meeting was a smoking meeting. I don't care where they met. My very first meeting, I thought that I had found the cure for alcoholism there, lung cancer. I mean, you could not see the first table. It was just like a solid wall of smoke. All just hovered about that high, But I went into that first meeting, and as we came in the door, this guy grabs my hand. He had a Levi coat on, a baseball hat, snowing, and he stuck his hand out and grabbed mine. And my father said, That's Jimmy, and he's your sponsor. And I got this guy holding on to my hand, squeezing my hand. He said, I'm Jimmy, and I'm glad to meet you. And I pray that I never forget that. And then Jimmy began to talk to me. My father took off, and I got this idiot holding on to my hand. And he began to talk to me, and he began to talk to me about himself. And we had nothing in common. He was from a hillbilly from West Virginia. He worked in a coal mine down there and had moved up to Ohio, worked in an auto factory. He had a different set of politics than I did. He belonged to churches that handled snakes. I mean, we had nothing in common. But as he talked to me about what happened when he drank and how he drank and how he tried to stop and how he tried to switch and how it got worse and about the shame and the guilt and the remorse that he felt and how he'd say, I'll never do it again, and he'd do it again and it'd get worse. I knew that he had lived like I lived and thought like I thought. And he told me how it got worse. And then he told me something magical. He said, and I haven't had a drink in almost 4 years or 4.5 years. And the meeting started, and I can't tell you anything about that meeting. I remember now the guy's name to talk was a guy named Dave. I can't tell you what he said. It was more or less a drunkalogue. You know, he told his story about what had happened to him, what he was like. The only thing I remember of any consequence of that meeting was that I laughed. And I had not laughed for many, many years. And I am a firm believer that the best thing we can do in Alcoholics Anonymous is laugh. You can take an inventory until you get carpal tunnel syndrome. But if you don't learn how to laugh, you're screwed. When you laugh, something happens. I found out later, I read a lot now and I've learned a lot more than I need, but I read that when you laugh, it lets endorphins loose. Now, that don't have nothing to do with getting horny or nothing. Endorphins. It's a thing that goes off in your brain. Do you know there's only a few ways to get it? One's by laughing, one's by taking chemicals, and the other is by running. Now, you can go out and run 4 miles, get your second wind, and get endorphins loose. Or you can laugh. Do I look like a runner or a laugher? And when endorphins get loose, look what just happened. When endorphins are loose, you can't think. You can't think, you can't be mad, you can't be horny, you can't be nothing. You're laughing, they're loose, you're free. So laugh, for God's sakes. That's all I remember from that first meeting is that I laughed. Then after the meeting, he introduced me to guys, people like you. There were guys with a lot of years and the guys with very little time. And he's introducing them to me, they're all saying, keep coming back, kid, you'll be all right. He introduced me to one guy, his name was Frank Turk. I got to tell you about Frank. Frank was old. He was in his late 50s, I think. He was bald-headed, and he had a gravelly voice. And Frank shook my hand. And Frank was sober a long time. He was sober almost 30 years. And he shook my hand, and he said, good to see you, kid, in his gravelly voice. And he says, keep coming. Things will be all right. He said, by the way, this is Mike or Al or whatever, some guy he had with him. He said, and I sponsor him, and he's got 2 weeks. That got my attention. 2 weeks. 30 years is a lie. I don't know about that. 2 weeks. How do you stay sober for 2 weeks? That was the amazing thing. And I turned to this guy. I might start talking to him. And he hadn't had a drink in 2 weeks. Tell you about Frank. Over the years, I go back and forth to Ohio for, you know, to see family periodically. And I go to meetings when I was up there. And I'll see Frank. I run into him occasionally. Whenever I see him, I say hello to him. He became a hero of mine. The last time I saw him a few years ago, I remember on the Near East Side, I went over to a meeting and he was there, and he's still bald and he's still older, still got that gravelly voice, but now he had 60-some years of sobriety, continuous. And I shook his hand and I said, Frank, it's good to see you. He said, good to see you, kid. He said, by the way, this is Billy or Al or whatever. He said, and I sponsor him, and he's got 10 days. I turned that kid to say hello and introduced myself, and I looked at Frank and said, Frank, you're sober 60-some years. You still sponsoring guys? Ah, kid, he said, I hate to do it. He said, but I can't drive no more. I need drivers. Who's he kidding? An active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, giving back what was so freely given to him. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous has given me everything that I ever dreamed, more than I have ever dreamed. I'll tell you, I'm not going to take you through 39 years of sobriety a day at a time, but I'll take you through a couple of things that happened and then tell you a couple things that happened since. The next day, we're going to a meeting. Jimmy gave me the answer to alcoholism that night. He asked me how I felt, and I told him I was scared and I was sick. And I was. I didn't know if I was an alcoholic, but I was sick. And he said, kid, he said, I'll make you a promise. If you'll do 3 things on a daily basis, I will guarantee you'll never have to come off another drunk. And I said, what are they? He said, number one, if you can, go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Number one, when you get up, say, God, help me not take a drink today. Number two, if you can, go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. There may be reasons when you can't go. You may have commitments, you may be back on a ship, but if you can, go. And number three, when you go to bed at night, say, thank you, God, for a sober day. And he looked me dead in the eye with those blue eyes of his, and he said, will you do it? And I said, Jimmy, I can do that stuff about going to meetings, but I can't pray because I don't believe in a God. And I told him about my past and what I believed in and how I did, it was just all gone. And he just chuckled. He gave me that AA chuckle. He said, I didn't ask you to pray and I didn't ask you to believe. I just said, will you say it? Being a professional liar, I could say anything. I said, yeah, I'll say it. The next day, we're on our way to a meeting. And he looked over at me and he said, have you had a drink, kid, since I dropped you off last night? I thought he'd lost his mind. I said, of course not. Now, the reason I said, of course not, sort of snotty, was he didn't drop me off till 3 in the morning. That's when he quit talking. Called me at 6 so I get that damn shot from that square needle in my left cheek. Called me at 8 to make sure I got back from the shot. Called me at 10, 12, 2, and 4. Picked me up at 7. I didn't have time to drink. He was always right there. But I didn't say that to him. I just said, no, I didn't. You'd have thought I won the lottery. He said, man, that's fantastic. He said, wow. I knew he'd lost his damn mind. He said, do you know you've just stayed sober the longest period of time you ever got to stay sober? Is he crazy? He said, no, one day. He said, that's all we do this thing, one day at a time. We just stay sober for one day. Now you use the strength of the day for tomorrow. You knew you did it today. Do the same thing tomorrow. You won't have to drink a day at a time. I'm glad he didn't say 90 and 30 or whatever the hell that catchphrase was that came out for. I'd have been screwed on 87. I know that, but one day I can handle. Today, that's what I can handle. One day, no matter what. You can tell me whatever's happened or going to happen in my life today, I can handle it one day at a time. That's what I can handle. It's called manageable. It's called attainable goals. We got a lot of words for it, but it's a day at a time. We went on to the meeting, and about 2 weeks sober, we're heading home from a meeting. I'm getting ready to go back to Florida where I lived. And he looked over at me and said, how's it going, kid? Everything all right? I said, yeah. I said, I still don't believe in this God nonsense. And he said, let me ask you something. He said, today was the first day you'd done anything in AA other than drink the coffee and eat the donuts. What was it? I said, well, I read the traditions. He said, before you read them, what did you say? I said, I'm Jay and I'm an alcoholic. He said, do you believe that? And I said, yes, I do. By then I believed what the doctor had written about the obsession of the mind and the allergy of the body. I knew that I had this thing that you call alcoholism. Didn't know how I had it, why I had it, what didn't make any difference. I knew that I had this thing. And I didn't have to know because he used the word. I don't know. But anyhow, he said, have you been doing what I told you every morning and every night? He said, the meetings we ain't going to ask about. We didn't ask about the meetings because he took me every night. He was always there. I didn't know I had a choice about going to meetings, so I went back to Florida. I mean, by then I was screwed. I was in that rhythm every day to go to a meeting. But I said, yeah, I've been doing it. I said, but you know, I'll say sometimes in the morning, God, help me not drink, and I'll be thinking about drinking. I said, there's times at night I'll go to bed and I'll say, thank you for a sober day, and I don't mean what I'm saying. I really wish I'd have been drunk that day. It had been a bad day. There had been some things that happened, a fight, an argument with her, or whatever. He said, that's all right. Thinking ain't drinking. Drinking is drinking. We ain't got no chapter into thinking. And then he asked me the question that changed my life. He said, how long have you been doing this, a day at a time? And I told him real quick, 13 or 14 or 15 days. It was a long, long time, Kent. And he said, well, just one last question. He said, when was the last time that you've gone this long, a day at a time, without having to take a drink? And a feeling came over me that I can only describe to you. It was just like a shroud, like the feeling just covered me, a knowledge that there was a power that I later was able to identify as a God, that had given me this ability, this way, not to drink a day at a time for that unbelievably long period of time, a day at a time. And I knew then that there was a power personal to me. And it has taken me 39 years to develop from there to where I am today and where I am with that belief in that power. And I am not going to go through all that with you. I will tell you how I attained it, though. You know, I didn't drink, and I went to meetings, and I went back on ships, and I did well on ships. And I made money, and I went into a smuggling business and When I got out of that, I began to work the steps. It was either that or go to jail. My sponsor said I was either going to drink or kill somebody, or I could work the steps. So I thought working the steps was a better alternative. That's what I'd done. We started on the steps on a Tuesday, a year and a half sober. By Friday, I was making amends. Desperation makes you move forward. Nowhere in the book does it say have three therapy sessions, talk with four counselors, and see a group of people about to do the second part of what it says next and at once and then. Words that imply constant action. I got to step 9 and I found in my inventory that what I'd been, it wasn't the things I had done to my parents or what they had done or not done to me. What it boiled down to is that they'd done the very best they could do and that I was a lousy son. And that my amend was going to be that I'd have to be a loving son. I'd been a lousy husband. I had to be a loving husband. The places where I'd stolen money and done things, I was able to write that down, my part in the wrong, so I knew what I was going to have to do to amend those relationships. With my family, because I told you a little bit about them, I'll tell you what I did with that. I called my mother on that Friday. It was the first time I talked to her in a long, long time. And when she answered the phone, I said, "Mom, this is Jay." She said, "I know who it is." I said, "I just wanted to say hello. I got to go now. I'll call you next week." And I began to call her every week. This is in 1975. And I began to call her every week, and I began to talk with her, and I began to ask her questions, and I'd write down the answers to the questions I'd ask her. And I began to build a line of communication with her. I talked to her about stuff that I had no interest in, didn't care nothing about. But I wanted to be a loving son, so I'd write down what I asked and what she answered, and then the next week we continued where we left off. And over the course of time, I was able to be able to build a relationship with my mother. And this woman whom I didn't like and didn't love, I learned how to both like and love. And I became that loving son. And my mother contracted a disease called diabetes. And they started cutting off with her big left toe, with her big toe on her left foot. And by the time they finished, there was nothing left from her hips down. They took it off a slice at a time. And I'd go up to see her, and I'd help my sister out with what was going on with her. And just did the things that you had told me I was supposed to do to be a loving son. And I just come back from visiting them in Ohio, and I got a call from my sister. I'd been up there, and about 2 weeks later, I got a call, and my sister said, "Mom's dying, and she wants to see you." I said, "I'll be up there tonight." And I flew up there to Cleveland and went over to Parma Hospital where she was. And she was in one of them rooms where they had the terminally ill, and she was just getting down near the end. And as I walked in, there were doctors and nurses hovering around, and my sisters were there. As I walked in, the room lit up. Just lit up with a smile on her face because I walked in saying, "Hi, Mom." And she had this big grin on her face. And the nurse looked at her and said, "This must be your son you're telling us about." And my mom was just beaming. She said, "Yeah." She said, "That's my son, Jay." She said, "You know, he's the best son a mother could ever want. He loves me." And she said, "You know, he's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if he stays sober until March the 8th, he'll have 25 years of continuous sobriety." This is in 1999. And I cried. And you gave me that. You gave me that by not letting me tell her I was sorry. You gave me that by telling her that what I had to do was amend the relationship. And to amend the relationship meant repair it. My wife, God, she was fantastic. In 1992, she had a massive heart attack and stroke. Over the next 8 years, or 93 she had, the next 7 years she had 13 more heart attacks, 3 major strokes, I don't know how many TIAs, breast cancer, and she died of renal failure in my arms on July 12th of 2000. And I was able to care for her. I didn't have to have nurses in or anyone else. I took care of her up until the last day. The day before she died, I had to call hospice in because I could no longer get enough medicine in her. And they had to come over and help me. And I was able to repair that relationship. I'd learned how to become a faithful husband. It didn't happen overnight. But I learned how to give her those things that I'd taken in those vows. And I was able to do that not because of the vows that I took, but because of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And because of the experience of a sponsor who had worked the steps. Not a sponsor who told me what I had to do, but who told me what he had done to get these things accomplished. I remember going over to her just before she died, and I held her. She was in one of those hospice beds, and I went over and I just held her, and I said, told her that I loved her. And I said, "I wish I'd have been a better husband." And she looked up at me, and those beautiful eyes of hers, and just gave me the smallest of squeezes. And she just said, I love you. She said, and I thank God for having given you to me as a husband. And she died. And that is not a sad story. That is the story of the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because left to my own devices, when she was going through that horrific period, my thoughts would have been, God, if I just took a drink, things would be better. If I just took one drink, I could get out of this mess. I wouldn't have to worry about this. If I didn't, I was able to turn my thoughts to her because of what you showed me how to do. Not because I knew what to do, because you showed me what to do. And she died. Since her death, I would like to tell you I'd been uninvolved, but that'd be a damn lie. I got married a bunch of times, made a bunch of mistakes, and then I found one on a 12-step call, 7,500 miles away. Met a woman on that 12-step call who was younger than any of my children. Had no intention of sleeping with her or marrying her. Did both. We've been together 5 years, and she is a partner. She is a partner. And I'm able to be a good husband to her. And I'm able to do for her the things that you showed me what to do. You know, my children and I, fantastic relationships. Fantastic. They call me on a weekly basis, and I'm involved in their lives. My dad and I, I'll finish up with my dad. Dad died in 1981. We never got close. We never had that warm, fuzzy relationship. I'm an emotional guy. My dad was a cold guy in many ways. He was intellectually arrogant, really. And he had cancer, and it was getting real bad, and a few months before his death, he sold everything or got rid of everything they had in Ohio and moved to Florida. So thought things he was going to escape things. And he went down there and he shut us all off. But none of us kids see him. He was so ashamed of what was happening to him physically. And I'd call there on a daily basis and talk to my mom, and she'd tell me what was going on and how things were getting worse physically with him. And I just didn't know if things were right. And I went to my, at that time, sponsor, who's now gone. I just said, I don't know if I've made amends or not. I've done all this. He said, just be a loving son. And at that point, I thought I had been, but I said, what should I do? He said, if you're a loving son, you'll know what to do. And what I did was let him alone. I didn't push myself where I wasn't asked, but I allowed him to die with the dignity that he wanted to die with and the privacy that he wanted. And on my AA birthday that year, this is in 1981, I got a card in the mail. It's my seventh AA birthday, and a card come in the mail, a thick card. I opened it up, and there were just scribbles on it. I couldn't read it. I could just see Love, Dad. I couldn't read the scribbles, and a letter fell out, and I read the letter. It was from my mother. And the letter explained the card. It said your father wanted to communicate with you on your AA birthday because he thought it was a special time, and he had special things to say, and he truly loves you. She said, and as he tried to write it, he couldn't get it down. So she said, I wrote it down, and he tried to copy it. And he couldn't do that. And he said, at that point, he looked up at her and accepted his imminent death and said, Rita, I'm a sick man and I know I'm going to die soon. She said, but it's important you know what he was trying to say. And she had it in quotes and said, dear son, congratulations on your AA birthday. What a glorious and wonderful day. He said, and how can we ever be grateful enough to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and for all that it's given us? For it's given us a loving God, who's returned a lost son and rediscovered a lost father. And I knew at that moment that everything was okay between me and Dad and God. The amend had been made and it was complete. He died shortly after that. You know, I could go on for a long time telling you about the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous and what's happened in my life, but your butt's getting tired and your ears are getting plugged up, so I'm going to finish with one thing. I've heard a lot of good things so far this weekend, and I'll hear a lot more good things. But I'll tell you this. This is a guy that has fallen so many times. I've come so short so many times. And every time I've fallen down, I've done something, I'd wake up with shame, guilt, and remorse. God would give me another shot, and let me try again. And every time I fell, I thought it'd be the last. He picked me up and gave me another chance. And then on March the 8th, my God reached down and gave me the greatest gift that could ever be given to a drunk like me. He gave me the opportunity to become a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And through that, I've come to know my God through you. Thank you for Alcoholics Anonymous and my God.